What is up, everybody? I'm sure if you've been watching the news, you all know that Hurricane Milton is coming my way. So I just got back from Kentucky yesterday after I went up to Kentucky because my mom had a triple bypass heart surgery. Ended up having to buy two or three different plane tickets to get home. Anyhow, that's besides the point. Real quick, as a reminder, the Patreon giveaway is still good to go. At the end of the month of October, we're giving away the 1791 Everyday Carry Toolkit Pack. Over $100 in value. Head over to D-410-1791 to get an idea of what the gift pack contains. And also for more information about how you can acquire some 1791 Everyday Carry tool holsters and Everyday Carry holsters, head over to D-410.com/1791 for more information there. Thank you guys for your continued support. Please enjoy this best of episode, and we'll be back, God willing, next week. No, seriously, like the last time we had a big hurricane, I didn't have power for 16 days. So you never know.
Digital 410 proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II based. That's an important message for tonight, World War II based podcast. Henry is still out working on his book. Jeff's got things going on. That's okay. We're going back old school. We're going back with a one-on-one episode. And I said tonight, an important part of our theme is base, because tonight we're going to go back before World War II. We're going to go back to the Great Depression. And some interesting facts I found out through watching videos and then watching a semi-historical fiction movie called Amsterdam, which I thought was very interesting and brought me up to speed on what I thought was fictional, until I do what I always do, which is get out the Google box and start Googling characters from this movie. And I found out, yes, the movie is fake, but the through line was based on true events, and true events that I was surprised I'd never really heard of, considering I've been running a World War II based podcast since 2018, and I have been reenacting since, 11 years now. So I did what I always do. I need to find somebody who knows more than me on this particular subject, and I found a gentleman. Colin, welcome to the show. First and foremost, let me just put this out there. For those of you familiar with Mr. Colin D. Heaton, yes, he knows a lot about aviation. No, we're not going to talk about it tonight because Jeff would kill me, because as you guys know, Jeff is a huge World War II aviation fan, and the fact that Colin did some consulting on Masters of the Air, we won't get into that tonight, but perhaps if everything goes according to plan tonight, we'll have Colin on a future episode with Jeff and Henry, and we'll talk World War II aviation. But right now, we're going to focus on the Great Depression shortly. More importantly, the Bonus Army March, and then what has become known to be as the quote-unquote business plan. But Colin, how are you doing tonight, sir?
Oh, pretty good.
I appreciate
just working on a few projects.
What are you working on now? I know you just released a book earlier this year, which was Above the Pacific, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm working on a few film projects right now with some people. Put things together and getting contacts ready for investor meetings, things like that.
Fantastic. I guess maybe when things come to fruition, you can come on and promote those. But give our audience a little bit more history about you, other than the fact that you write fantastic books. You have quite a library of books, and we will include all those over on WTSP World War II. We'll put a link to you can see and purchase Colin's books. But give our audience a little background on you. I understand you not only served in the Army, but the Marine Corps. Is that correct?
Yeah, I served 3 years in the Army, got out, and a friend of mine was a recruiter for the Corps, and he suggested that I go back to work. And so I took him up on his offer, and I did. So I spent a few years there, and then after that, I went to college, and then graduate school, then postgraduate school, began teaching and writing, and all during those years, I would travel between Europe and the U.S., and I was always interviewing, Africa, but I was interviewing people, mostly World War II vets, but I got a couple of World War I veterans and they were still alive. So
you're the few who were lucky enough to get those.
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah, I got two Germans and three Americans and one British gentleman.
And the fact that film was at such an early adaptation back then, clearly, obviously we don't have half as much as the context and content we do on World War II. And so for you to get the verbal memories from those gentlemen probably meant a lot to you and provided tremendous value to you and your colleagues.
Well, yeah, but I did it as a hobby for 20, 30 years because some people collect stamps, some people collect coins, comic books. I collected people's stories. I collected interviews. That was what I wanted to do. And when I was in high school, I was in middle school when I was able to meet General Omar Bradley and talk to him. And we had a pretty good short conversation, not an interview. But and then later on, I became acquainted with a few authors who I had written to courtesy of their publishing companies. And one became a very good friend, Colonel Raymond F. Tolliver, who introduced the world to the German fighter pilots, but he had good contacts. And so I began writing letters and had phone calls. And over a period of time, I was able to get together with most of these gentlemen and some women and start compiling a library, which I never really thought I'd be writing books about these people until I found out that, some of these books are pretty popular. But also found out it was the most difficult thing other than a blind man probing a minefield was getting a book published. Yeah. So, once I cracked the secret and had a couple of good agents, my latest agent I'm still with for 15, 17 years, I guess now.
Congratulations on that.
So once you have a good agent and you've got a decent product, it's just a matter of finding the right publishing company.
And that's a huge thing, whether it's being an author, a musician, an actor, an athlete. Those industries in and of itself, anytime you attach the word entertainment or money to it, there are so many people looking for a quick way to scam others. And as you said, once you find a good agent, you got to hold on to them with all their worth and just trust them. They trust you. You got to build that relationship. And once you get a good one who's not out to, you know, pull a fast one, especially when you're up and coming, you know, you're young and to whatever particular industry is, it's just like anything else. There's always those people out there looking to take advantage of others. And once you find a good one, you just got to hold on to them.
Oh yeah. And I got lucky because my friend, who's also my entertainment lawyer, knew her, and she had represented some very prestigious authors in the past. She was Eric Hamill's agent for a while.
Oh, okay.
And so she carried a lot of weight in the military history. All she represents is military history. So she specializes, and we've had a great working relationship. So,
well, that's part of the reason why Henry can't be here tonight. I'm not sure if you're aware, but Henry has basically recovered. When his father put out with the old breed, the original manuscript, I think, was roughly 640 pages. But the publisher said, hey, we're only interested in about 350. And so some of that context went on to be China Marine, but a lot of it has never been seen, never been published. And so Henry's actually taken his father's, the remaining part of that manuscript, and he's reworking on it and adding his sense experience with his father post-war and some of his father's tellings and memories of it. And he's actually working on a book in an effort to get his father's unpublished work out there into the world, so, you know, fans of Eugene Sledge can get more content from his father. And so that's why he's kind of stepped away from the show. He's still part of the show, but he's on hiatus just because he's working a full-time job and trying to get that book out. And as you know, getting a book out, especially when it's going to be your first one, it takes a lot of time to get that just right. This episode is brought to you by our friends over at Fume. Fume cartridges are crafted from medical-grade polyester designed for use with essential oils. Fume, a non-vape, non-nicotine, non-tobacco device, works by replacing the hand-to-mouth fixation, calming nervous tension through fidgeting, and distracts you from the bad habits with delicious flavors. Psychologists have shown stopping a bad habit cold turkey is very hard for your brain. The Fume handheld device has a built-in fidget, also has a weight similar to most vape pens. If you're interested in replacing old bad habits with new good habits, head on over to tryfume.com/D410M and get yourself a free pack of toppers with your purchase. The toppers is a perfect new accessory designed with your comfort in mind. Slip it onto the mouthpiece for a softer, warmer feel. So replace those old habits with a new habit, a good habit. Simply go to tryfume.com/D410M. That's tryfume.com/D410M.
Well, I mean, the good thing is, I mean, he's working off his dad's work, which Eugene Sledge's memoir is like legendary in the Marine Corps. And
absolutely.
It's like absolute, it's required reading. And if I give an example, that's not that unusual, because I'm going to release the second edition of my book, The Star of Africa, because I had a word count restriction. I had to be well below 100,000 words, but I had like 130 some odd thousand words worth of material. They said, no, you got to trim it down. So how do you cut out great stuff and still tell the story? So I did the best I could, but now that I have a new publisher, in fact, Dale Dye and his wife, Julia, their publishing company, Warrior Publishing, are going to take care of it and get the second edition out.
Congratulations on that. Is it easier when you're, I don't want to say easier, but is it the process quicker when you go back and pull up material you had already written? Or is it harder because now you got to figure out how to take that content that's already had the beginning and the end cut off of it and then retell it in a new way, but still get to that part of the timeline that was cut out of the original book?
Well, for me, it was really easy because I had the original manuscript, and all I had to do is edit the original manuscript that I kept a copy of the long version, and I trimmed down the short version for the first edition book that came out in 2012, but I still had the long version. So I didn't have to do any extracurricular work on that. It was already there. I just had to make sure it had a better edit. And then I had more information that I gathered from over the years from a gentleman in Australia whose uncle was killed by the subject of the book, The Star of Africa. And I managed to get some stuff from him that I also wanted in the book. But what I left out of the first edition was a lot of interview material that I had with a lot of the Allied pilots, Australians, South Africans, Canadian, and even other Germans, and expanded interview material that really told the story of Hans Marseille, because they either fought against him or they flew with him, they knew him. And so the story is... It's a more well-rounded version of that man's life and the people he knew and the people who were involved, because now you have a broader picture. And I'm sure that when he releases the additional unpublished material from his father's book, it's going to be a more complete picture of what he wanted to say.
Well, you're the perfect person to ask. Clearly, you wrote the original manuscript in 2012. I'm assuming it took you a few years of research, but clearly the internet has come a long way, and people who, since 2012, more and more analog documents have probably been digitized, put into databases. Did you find that when you're working on the material that you collected in 2012 and you research, and now that you're fine-tuning it, and I'm assuming you probably went out and did some additional research, did you find that you're finding stuff that you weren't aware of back then just because more content is being digitized and made more readily available on the internet?
A couple of things that were new to me that I did not know had survived the war, but I didn't really have to do a lot of digging for them, because a lot of my historian friends loved the book and they want to see the full story told. And Robert Tate, Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Tate, he's retired now, but he wrote a book on Hans-Joachim Marseille, which I thought was a great book, and then mine came out. So we were competing books with the same subject, but Bob Tate really helped out with some information, and an Australian researcher named Nick Hector, he's become a friend, he helped out with a lot of additional material that I did not have access to because I've not been to Australia. So really, a lot of the stuff that's online, a lot of it you can't trust unless it is from an archive. But I spent so much time in the archives in Germany and in Britain and in France and Italy and going through documentation and Canada, that it was nice to have corroborating material from other sources, you know? And my problem that I like to solve is mysteries. And mysteries I like to solve is what Bob Tate does and Nick Hector does and I did. And we would like to, if there was an air combat involving a German or an American, British pilot, whoever, and he shot down somebody, how much luck are we going to have finding out who that guy was he shot down? And that's what I became pretty good at. Bob's great at it. And Nick's great at it. And what I did over the years was I was able, if they were still alive, if I most of my interviews were with Germans, the Luftwaffe guys, but I give an example. I interviewed Walter Kropinski the first time in with Steinhoff in 84. And then around 2000, I managed to figure out, or 1999, I guess, I managed to figure out who this one particular Soviet pilot was that Kropinski shot down. Wow. I found out he was still alive. And the story goes that Kropinski was in a big dogfight with Gunther Rall and Hartmann and Steinhoff and Rauback. I mean, the legends of JG-52. And Kropinski had flamed this guy up. But he pulled alongside him, much like Marseille would do. And he motioned to the guy. And Kropinski said to me, he was just a child. He looked like he was 15 years old. Yeah. So he motions to the guy, go ahead and jump out. I'm not going to kill you. So the guy jumps out. And he remembered the aircraft markings. And he put it into his after action report. And I was talking to a friend of mine in Russia who had fled Russia. He's not exactly on Putin's Christmas list.
I can imagine not.
Yeah, but he was this was back in 97 and 98, and he was a historian, Russian historian, and he said, give me the information about that, the date, the time, and all that. And so we, after about a year or so, we cross-referenced, and I found out that this Ukrainian pilot was still alive, so I managed to get him to come to the Gemeinschaft der Jagdflieger, because I would go, you know, every year that I could to Germany for the World War II reunion. And I managed to get Kropinski to meet the guy that he let live. And the guy showed up with his wife, his daughter, his son, three grandkids, a great grandchild. And the guy didn't speak German, and Kropinski didn't speak Russian, but we had a Russian interpreter there. And my Russian is terrible. My German's pretty good, but my Russian's terrible. But finally, Kropinski had told the guy, he said, well, I'm glad you lived because you have a beautiful family. And the guy broke down and cried, and his wife cried, and they hugged each other. He said, if you had killed me, I wouldn't have this wonderful family.
Yeah, I was going to say, you could probably cut the emotions in that room with a piece of cheesecake, just because it had to be so thick. I mean, I could only imagine to be just a fly in the wall in that situation where you have two gentlemen who interacted with each other, depending on when this reunion started, anywhere between 60 to 85 years ago, and then had their family, their children, their great-grandchildren there. I couldn't imagine.
And that was great. I mean, there were so many stories like that Saburo Sakai, the Japanese ace, I mean, he finally got to meet the co-pilot of a DC-3 that he did not shoot down because he saw it was carrying women and children fleeing Indonesia. Wow. And so he waved his other pilots off and said, you know, we're not going to shoot this guy down, you know, as civilians, we don't do that kind of thing. And then later on, that KLM pilot had showed up with his family and met Saburo, and, you know, and so these are the kinds of stories I like to get out there. Like one of the books I want to write, everyone can write about battles. I've written about battles. I've written about, you know, war crimes. I wrote a book called Occupation Insurgency. I interviewed the last living, 12 SS generals.
Wow.
But I want to tell the stories of the humanity of war.
The guys
who spent years trying to kill each other, but because they didn't lose their humanity, that they did something that would be totally abstract, abnormal, and probably get a few of them shot, but they did it anyway. Then that's what my book, The Star of Africa, was about, because Marseille shot down, he was credited with 158 aircraft, but he killed a lot of pilots, but that wasn't his intent. But he ended up saving, mathematically calculating, the guys he let bail out, the guys he allowed to crash land, and the guys that he allowed to become prisoners of war, or the people who were wounded that he couldn't get to, that he would fly to the enemy airbase or write a note in perfect English and say, your guy shot down here, these coordinates, go get him. He saved 17 lives that he could have taken, but he didn't. To me, that's the best part of the story, other than the fact that he, you know, really pissed off Hitler, Goering, Himmler, and Bormann, and the rest of them during a piano concert where he played jazz. But the humanity stories. You know,
yeah.
There are so many. I've got probably 100 such stories. Most people would be stunned to know that SS Lieutenant General Paul Hauser and Brigadier General, later at the end of the war, he's promoted Brigadier General Leon de Grel, the Belgian SS commander of the Legion of Wallonian, actually cleared an entire village in the Ukraine. And when they cleared the village, they found that the civilians came up out of these holes in the ground, and they were talking to them. And make a long story short, they said, well, where is your priest? Because all the priests ought to have been killed by the NKVD or sent to gulags. And so they had a priest in hiding and brought him out. So Gila and de Grel got permission from Hitler and Himmler to rebuild the church that had been damaged. So they rebuilt the church. They had soldiers set all around the perimeter on a Sunday service, so they could have their first church service since the Bolshevik Revolution.
Wow.
And this was in 1942. And I thought that was a pretty wild story. And I actually managed to meet an older lady who was a teenage girl at the time, who says,